Welcome to the Tom Dupree Show. Today we have a very exciting guest. It's James O'Keefe, who is founder of Project Veritas. He's a pull-no-punches journalist, a political activist, and an author of a brand new book called American Muckraker. Over to you, Tom.
This is Psalm 31. In you, O Lord, I have taken refuge. Let me be never put to shame. Deliver me in your righteousness. Turn your ear to me. Come quickly to my rescue. Be my rock of refuge, a strong fortress to save me. Since you are my rock and my fortress, for the sake of your name, lead me and guide me. For those of you who listen to our radio show and have for the last several years, I have quoted from different people, different folks out there that I believe are doing something of note in this world, especially with the incredible depth of deception and evil and absolute lying that goes on in our public sphere. We truly live in a day and age when the truth is a lie, and the lie is the truth. It's everything's all upside down. And one of the people that I have quoted from and talked about is James O'Keefe with Project Veritas, who has had, and I'll just say it, the balls to go right into certain situations numerous times and reveal nefarious and covered up activities that so many people are in on that it's very hard, in some cases impossible, for people to see what he's doing as the truth. Rather, he's excoriated and demonized for simply telling the truth. All you need to know, you can find by looking at his Wikipedia page, which has been so incredibly doctored and slimed by untruths and things like that. So, you know, James is, this is a really voyage of the soul. And he does talk about this in this new book of his called American Muckraker, which is an intensely personal voyage into, you know, kind of this world of deceit and things of that nature, where you don't know who's you can depend upon or not. So, James, listen, thank you. I know you're a real busy guy these days. You're out talking to people. You got stuff going on all the time. I appreciate the fact that you're actually spending some time with us. We feel very privileged. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yes. So, James, you know, we had dinner the other night in Arizona. One of the things that touched me about your story was talking about growing up, working with your dad on the houses and things, and your granddad. You had this strong sense of family, people in your family who really got things done and did stuff. And it seems like you never really had probably any doubt that you could do whatever you set your mind to do.
Yeah, I write about in this book, American Muckraker. Well, I actually don't really talk about my childhood as much, but I write about kind of the idea, the themes of suffering and struggle and resilience and character really is a theme I write about in this book. What the traits of an investigative reporter, the kind of indefatigability, which means just never giving up. And, you know, failure is never really in the mind of an investigative reporter. And you might want to quit, but you don't. You just keep going. And oftentimes, something my dad taught me and my grandfather taught me, but failure is not an option, really, for the people who are doing this sort of work.
Right. I was very touched by the story about the rental property that your father had restored and built and kind of started with nothing and, you know, just put this thing together. And then you had this problem where it was nearly ruined. I don't remember if it was a fire or something like that. And then he just went back and just kept going again. That is what America is all about. It's not about this hand up from government. It's about individuals striving to build something on their own.
Yeah, that was a story I told you about resilience. You know, I was born in 1984, and in the 1980s, times were tough for our family. I'm from northern New Jersey. To make ends meet, my mom would wake up at 4 a.m. and head to the Bronx to work at a nursing home, and sometimes she took me with her at 4 a.m. We lived in this ratty old house in New Jersey and decided to fix it up, basically my dad, by himself with me and my mom. I was 5 years old, thinking he might rent out the top half of this carriage house. It was really, it looked like the Leaning Tower of Pisa. It was leaning off the perpendicular by, let's just call it 15 degrees. This was like almost condemned. It was built in like 1885. And my dad solicited the help of his grandfather, James O'Keefe Sr., to perform a miracle. My grandfather was dyslexic. He could build things out of nothing with scrap materials salvaged from the side of the road. So that's what he did. Three of us began working when I was five. In the beginning, I would hand them tools, really didn't do much more than hand them stuff. But my father was certainly one of the hardest, probably the hardest working man I've ever met. He would kind of just sort of figure out a way to make things work. He engineered ways to get things done. And I grew up in this weird place where I was every weekend and every evening helping my father and grandfather hand them tools. My grandfather would say to me, you know, I was sticking my little arm down a sewage pipe, and he would say, you know, you have to do what it takes to survive. I didn't really understand what he was talking about, but he would supervise me, monitor me, kind of micromanage me, scraping paint chips off a wall. And then as soon as we were done restoring one of these homes, the house burned down almost. Right. And I was, let's say, 10 years old. And we didn't, again, we had no money. Insurance didn't cover all of it. A tenant put the mattress next to the furnace, which was stupid. But for the next 2 years, my sister, mother, and father went back to doing all of the same work all over again. And this was like a lesson in my life. You know, you have to build things out of with worn out tools. You see the things you gave your life to broken, and you have to rebuild, which is a theme in my life and in everyone's life. I mean, we all go through some version of this. I guess I thought growing up, everyone grew up this way, as often children do. And then I realized, whoa, I had a pretty unique father and a pretty unique grandfather. So this is a characteristic of people who do this sort of work. Some people think I'm a masochist. I'm a sociopath for doing, you know, exposing these institutions. And for me, it's like, well, why wouldn't you do it? What we all suffer in some way or another. If you're a Christian, I think suffering is can be a very good thing. It can bring you closer to God. But I would rather follow my conscience and do the right thing. And yeah, we get beat up by the government. We get punished for doing it. But as long as you don't stop, as long as you keep going, you send a message to other people that they can do it too.
Okay, James, let's start with the kind of the first deal that you did where you came after the government of the Rutgers University for their cultural misappropriation of the Irish culture in the use of Lucky Charms cereal in the cafeteria. I like that story.
Well, that was when I was at a junior at Rutgers University, and this was in March of 2005. And in order to expose political correctness run amok, I went into the dining halls with a box of Lucky Charms and attempted to get them banned on the grounds they were racist against Irish people. And I actually succeeded in my satirical attempt. Now, irony is dead. You know, these days, that sort of thing isn't even funny anymore because it's happening. But in 2005, that was pretty funny, and we put the university in a bind. They could either remove Lucky Charms because they're racist against Irish people, in which case they become a laughingstock, or they can violate their own campus speech codes, which prohibit offending anyone for any reason. And it was sort of, it was putting these universities in a horrible decision where they had to choose the lesser of these two evils, which was to effectively remove Lucky Charms cereal from the cafeteria. And it was exposing them for what they are. It was getting them on videotape being who they are, and exposing them and lampooning them and lambasting them for who they are. And it was on video, and it was really funny. It was very hard for me to keep a straight face doing this sort of Borat meets 60 Minutes sort of interview. And then, I proceeded from there and went to do more of these sorts of things where I confronted professors with a camera. I talk about, again, if what is required, you think that I am not an extroverted person. You and I at dinner, and I'm rather shy at times. I don't like confronting people. I don't like confrontation.
Yeah, that's funny. I'm sorry. I'm laughing about
it. But a lot of people think, well, that would surprise you. That's surprising. Well, it is surprising, but I think that you kind of have to be that way, right? You have to be someone who you don't relish the spotlight. You don't want to do these things, but they're kind of necessary things to do. And that's very important. Again, qualities of an American muckraker, which I write about in this book.
Yeah, the book is highly personal. It uses allusions to literature throughout sort of Western history. And I find it the muckraker is sort of a figure who is a journeyman who can trust nothing nowhere, almost like Dante going into the pit of hell and not knowing exactly what it is he's seeing or whom he can lean upon. And that's the pilgrimage that one is on. So if you don't mind, the folks that are listening may or may not know about you and Project Veritas. Project Veritas is an organization that has emerged because the mainstream media no longer does the investigative kind of work that it used to do, hailing back to, say, Woodward and Bernstein back in the 70s. It's sort of gone into that gap or that vacuum. Talk about the first case that you worked on that helped Project Veritas achieve some notoriety.
Well, the biggest one was the Acorn story. Your audience probably, for those of you who don't know me, you certainly know of our work. For example, you know about the Planned Parenthood videos. Most people know about that. The fetal body parts harvesting, or the undercover work with Lila Rose, where we went in there and said we were underage and they told us how to get an illegal abortion. That was 14 years ago. Another one was the Acorn story with the pimp and prostitute going in. This is about 11 years ago. And we said that we were starting a child prostitution ring in these offices of Acorn. Acorn was a group that was getting government money to help people with loans and voter registration. They were accused of fraud. So we went in there as sort of secret shoppers testing the morality of these officials and caught them on tape telling us to disguise the prostitutes as dependents on our tax forms. And this was a huge story. This was on the front page of every newspaper for a week in September of 2009. And this sort of affirmed this sort of journalism, because American Muckraker, the book, is about what's happened in journalism. And, why does that matter? Why does that affect you? Why would you want to read a book about journalism? Well, because in this country, informed consent is everything. As Abraham Lincoln said, without public opinion, nothing matters. The First Amendment is first for a reason. It helps inform the population, which helps determine who gets elected. And in this age of, we throw out terms like misinformation and disinformation, oftentimes those terms are thrown out against me. But what do those terms even mean? It means, I guess, that the facts are correct, but we don't want the audience to draw the wrong conclusion, which is the exact opposite of how it ought to be. And the media is giving us the wrong facts. So journalism is printing what somebody else does not want printed. Journalism is not relaying from the powerful people what they want us to print. And a spokesman says, anonymous sources say, you have to challenge what those spokespeople are saying to you. You have to be skeptical. And in order to do that, we have to use hidden cameras and undercover work and whistleblowers, all these sorts of muckraky things that people used to do decades ago, maybe even 120 years ago, before the hidden camera was invented. And this book is really about the exploration of that genre and where the boundaries lie, what the ethics are, what's private anymore.
Well, nothing is private when it comes to the public life, unless certain powers that be keep it private. You know, you're simply trying to, it seems to me, bring forth things that are being kept private, kept from us, the participants in this Republican democracy that depends so much upon public opinion in order to make informed decisions. What is it in the body politic, in citizens, human beings these days in America, that has gone slack and said, I just don't care anymore. I am not a player. And a lot of this seems to happen because people just don't seem to care. That I simply cannot fathom, but that is the mental milieu of so many that we see these days.
What has happened to people?
Oh yeah, why is the critical part of their brain sort of gone slack or gone become non-functional?
Well, I mean, I attempt to answer that in this book. To me, that's one issue, but an even related to that issue is, why are people so afraid? My hypothesis I write about is that it's easier to believe what you see in the chyrons on CNN. And frankly, part of that stems from how difficult it is to challenge the chyron. The chyron is the thing on the lower part of the screen with the text on it.
Yes.
And you go to the airport and you see it. It's easier to go along. It's easier to not upset the apple cart. It's easier to have that malaise that you speak of. It's easier to not challenge the prevailing orthodoxy. And in a world where people place more value on their Twitter account, or as I put it in this book, American Muckraker, where what you put on Instagram is more important than your own sense of reality, that our the emphasis and the importance that we place upon these mediums, the media, and by the way, Google, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram are all part of the media, it's less likely you're going to challenge those institutions out of fear. You don't want to be given the scarlet letter. You don't want to be attacked. You don't want to have your reputation attacked. In the work that I've done, sometimes it dislocates my own sense of reality. It's a kind of psychological a torture. In combat, and I write about in this book, I read a chapter called Suffering. In combat, events have a duration of seconds, sometimes minutes, but what our whistleblowers go through when they take on Google and Twitter and Facebook and CNN, you're assaulted psychologically. You're assaulted financially, which is its own special kind of violence because it's directed at your children. So for me, half of it's a kind of laziness you describe. I think the other half of it is kind of social conditioning. You're not allowed to question the prevailing narrative. And if you do, you're targeted for it. So the easiest thing to do is just to look at that screen and look at that New York Times and look at that CNN and say, that's the way it is, even though that's the way it isn't.
Sure. Well, what I've said for years is that whenever the government passes a bill like the Affordable Health Care Act, it's always not what it says. It's misspeak. These things are always termed something to try to cover up what it is that they're really doing. And, you know, we see that with this voting rights speech that Biden made in Georgia the other day, which Georgia was the place where the biggest theft of it occurred. Elizabeth's sort of motioning to me, we got to go to a break here.
It's always on me, isn't it, Tom, when I'm cutting off a good conversation? You've been listening to the Tom Dupree Show. We have James O'Keefe of Project Veritas joining us this week. His motto is be brave, do something. We'll talk more about that in the second half of the hour. If you want to hear this show again, we will be posting it on our website, dupreefinancial.com, as are the rest of the Tom Dupree Show episodes. You can find them there as well. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Stay tuned. You do not want to miss it. I am an orphan girl. I have friendships. One was crooked, one was straight. Crimson bark and emerald needles growing day by day. And though they look so different, they enjoy the rain the same side by side. Chickadee told them of a darkness on the land, spinning blades that came to visit carried by a man. And every other tree would see them cut down where they stand by and by. Welcome back to the second half of the hour. We've got James O'Keefe joining us, the Pull No Punches journalist and founder of Project Veritas. Here's our host, Tom Dupree.
So, James, James O'Keefe, you know, you guys have gotten pretty good at fighting the defamation and the lies and the misinformation that comes at you and of which you are being accused, but it's actually the other side. In many cases, the New York Times has thrown all kinds of shade on you. It was specifically, it was really interesting how when the FBI raided your home, the New York Times sort of already had the story. It had been effectively downloaded to them. There have been numerous legal proceedings, not just with the New York Times, but that one I kind of stands out to me. And why don't you talk about some of this strategy that you've been employing to fight these people, which is turning out to be really a winning strategy?
Well, the bottom line is that we've never lost a lawsuit. Project Veritas has never lost a lawsuit. I'm probably one of the only chairmen of any media companies. Veritas is now a $20 million nonprofit organization. NPR is a nonprofit organization. A lot of nonprofit journalism organizations out there. We never lost a lawsuit. We never settled a lawsuit. I wrote a chapter in this book called Litigation, where I talk about why that is the case. Not because we've had all good judges, by the way. Seems to be what everyone's saying. Like, well, oh, justice is whose side you're on. Well, these are fundamental principles. Lot to say about this. Let me get started by saying, within minutes of me being out of handcuffs, the New York Times somehow knew the document I was holding in my hand after the FBI raid, which necessarily means that the FBI and the DOJ were coordinating and collaborating with the New York Times. Now,
think about that for a minute. That's an amazing thing right there, that two parts of the government are essentially giving their whole story to two huge media organizations.
Yeah, I mean, I could spend 20 minutes on any one of these things, but I'll start by saying I was in handcuffs. The FBI raided my home, which was an American disgrace. I mean, this was
it is
the Supreme Court of the United States has protected the right of a journalist to receive a document from a source, even if that document was stolen, so long as the journalist does not participate in the theft of that document. But I'm holding on to this search warrant, and the New York Times text messages me and somehow knows about it. Well, there's that. I sued the New York Times for defamation about a year ago. They had lied about me. They had intentionally lied about me. And in this defamation lawsuit against the New York Times, we score a massive victory. The judge in New York says that it was the New York Times that acted with deception and disinformation by calling our work, quote, deceptive. They didn't call anyone for comment when they wrote the article. They admitted in court they got the facts wrong. They said it was perfectly legal what the guy that we reported on did when it was illegal, and they admitted it was illegal. He was harvesting ballots in his car. So we sued them. We score a massive victory. And frankly, the judge came out and said, you sequester O'Keefe's legal memos. You can't publish their attorney-client privilege documents, which somehow the New York Times got access to after the FBI raid. So people are defending the New York Times when the New York Times has admitted in court they lied about me and we've won, and now they're attacking the judge. So the court question is, who can hold the New York Times accountable, if right. not the judge? I mean, they think they're above the law. They think they're above reproach. They think that logic doesn't apply to them. It's the law of non-contradiction. Don't say you got the facts wrong, but then refuse to correct the article. And I mean, this is happening in every lawsuit we ever litigate. It goes to a jury verdict or summary judgment, and it gets thrown out because when you actually open up the facts and you look at the reality, we're not lying. We're telling the truth. And they like to throw mud at me. Go Google my name and you'll read my Wikipedia page. It'll evoke audible gasps when you do so, because you'll think I'm a monster.
Yeah.
But when you actually go into a court of law, you can't play those games. In cross-examination and deposition, right. 2 + 2 = 4, still, at least hopefully for, you know, as long as we can do in this country, and we've never lost a lawsuit. And the reason why that is because we behave ethically and we don't try to keep secrets. They have a lot of secrets to keep and they do not behave ethically.
You know, something, if you could get a visual of this, the New York Times has a very nice building. I think it's on 6th Avenue or somewhere in Manhattan. You know, says the New York Times on it. It's in downtown Manhattan. The headquarters of Project Veritas is in Mamaroneck up in Westchester County. It was totally flooded and essentially wiped out, I don't know, 3 months ago or something during the flooding up there. You talk about David and Goliath, and that's not even the right description. And these guys have continued to prevail. So listen, I got to say, only in America, we should be happy that we still have enough of a court system that Project Veritas can bring their cases, and even going into, you know, hostile territory, the Southern District of Manhattan, that is not a friendly area for conservatives, and still prevail. That's amazing.
Well, yeah, I mean, we won in New York State Court. A judge on Christmas Eve ruled that the New York Times violated our attorney-client privilege rights, and we are suing the New York Times, and the New York Times publishes my attorney-client memos. They've done some a dozen or so hit pieces against me. And the challenge is, you know, the reason why I keep talking about the New York Times, I could tell you stories that would blow your mind about all the different lawsuits that we've been involved in. Each of these stories would take me more than a few minutes to tell. But the bottom line is, the reason why the New York Times is so powerful is because the Google, Twitter, and Facebook gives them that power. They prefer their articles and their algorithms. They set the agenda. And all the people in the government, the Pentagon, you know, the military, pharmaceutical companies, legislative branch of government, executive branch of government, White House, they use the New York Times as their spokespeople. They give them what to print, and they print it like good little puppy dogs.
Right.
That's not journalism. That's not the way it should be. Journalism is about reporting the truth, even if it runs in the face of what your sources tell you. So the New York Times thinks they're God. And I know that Dean Baquet, the executive editor of the New York Times, said, quote, "We don't get religion," unquote. Well, maybe that's because they think they're gods. They, think of it. Who can hold them accountable? A judge says you lied about James O'Keefe. You can't print this. And they say, well, screw you. We're going to print it anyway.
Right.
What? I know we have a First Amendment in this country, but the First Amendment is not absolute. You can't intentionally lie. It's established Supreme Court precedent under New York Times versus Sullivan. You can't commit actual malice against a public figure. And frankly, that's part of that. That's why we are so divided in this country. There's not multiple realities. There's not multiple truths. There's only one reality. And when you do this, you will be attacked. But we have won every time, and it's emboldened our whistleblowers and our sources to come to us. They don't go to the New York Times and Washington Post. They come to Project Veritas.
So we're promoting, with James is promoting a book called American Muckraker. What would be the best place for someone to just go buy that book right now, James?
I mean, you could go on Amazon. It got to number four. This is a top 10 books in the world on Amazon. And also, if you want an easy website to remember, just go to AmericanMuckraker.com. AmericanMuckraker.com will redirect you to the page that you can buy the book about what I'm telling you. And all proceeds from this book go to our nonprofit, Project Veritas, pays our journalist salaries. Unlike NPR, we don't get money from the government, by the way. And no one tells us what to do. So I talked to you about this at dinner. People are under the impression, oh, you have donors. No, they don't direct our activities.
Yeah,
our stories are determined by the whistleblowers, the people that have these, like the story we did 2 weeks ago inside the Department of Defense with a document showing that Anthony Fauci lied. So go buy the book at AmericanMuckraker.com. It is an absolutely, it reads like a Dostoevsky novel meets John Grisham thriller novel. And you could also pick up the audiobook there if you'd like, and we appreciate your support.
James, you guys are constantly working on stories. Talk a little bit about kind of the nuts and bolts of what drives a story for Project Veritas, kind of from the beginning to the end. I mean, it's like sometimes you don't know where the next story is coming from. That is driven by somebody who's a whistleblower coming forth and saying, I've got something I need to talk to you guys about.
Yeah, and I appreciate you saying that, because I think you're correcting a misconception. We don't know where the next story is going to come. We're doing a story in 2 days from now that'll blow your mind. It's about, give you a little, break a little news on your program. How about that? This is about child vaccine misconduct, right? Kids and I can't say more, but it's about the vaccine and children. And it's not my words. It's not my claims. These are claims from the pro-vax community that talk about the what's happening with the vaccine injected into children. And I didn't set out going, I'm going to do a child vaccine story. I had no, I mean, I'd love to expose that, but I didn't say, let's go get one. A young woman from this program came to us, and she was very scared. And I interviewed her, and it wasn't just her testimony. She had evidence. She had video clips. And then we went out into the field. We dispatched our reporters to go talk to these people. And then we just today and tomorrow reaching out to comment to the organizations involved. So someone will reach out to us with a tip, you know, like a maybe a piece of footage or a photograph, and then we'll send our team out to corroborate it.
Yeah.
That's what journalists are supposed to do.
I mean,
it sounds like, oh, well, the company says X, so I'm going to report X. That's not what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to question X and see if that is the reality.
Another thing you can do, and I just tell people, go to the Project Veritas website. If you want to simply make a donation to the work of Project Veritas, as Elizabeth and I have, and I would absolutely implore you, you know, to consider doing it yourself. This is an investment in the truth. These people are putting out there the kind of work, you know, that needs to be done in journalism everywhere. And if you're subscribing to a major newspaper, throughout this country somewhere. You're probably buying into some kind of propaganda. This is not the case. James, not the case with Project Veritas. Hey, James, what is the funniest thing that you guys have done? Now, I got my top one. It's where you where you got on the call with Jeff Zucker of CNN.
Yeah, that's probably the funny. I mean, I would say that by acclamation, I mean, that's probably the funniest. Yeah.
Talk a little bit about what happened there. That's a blast.
We were listening into the Jeff Zucker 9 a.m. conference calls with his CNN staff. Jeff Zucker is the president of CNN, CEO of CNN, and we listened to, I don't know, 2 months of these calls. And then on December 1st of 2020, I dialed in and I unmuted myself and was like, hey, Jeff, this is James O'Keefe from Project Veritas. And he was just like, he goes, hello. You'd think he would hang up, but he goes, yes. And then I say, hey, I got to ask you a question. You think you guys are doing journalism, but I've been listening to your calls for 2 months, and I don't see a lot of journalism happening. And Jeff Zucker goes, I'm not making this up. He goes, thank you very much for your comment. And then he tells everyone else on the call, we're going to have to change the system here because our system, our phone lines have been compromised. Like, this is live. It's happening in real time. He's on the phone with all of his executives, journalists, CNN. And then we live streamed this moment. We live streamed it before the world. So if I had not unmuted myself at that exact moment in time, I would not have gotten it. So these are just the funny things about life, and truth is stranger than fiction.
Yeah. Well, what does it take to be a Project Veritas employee? Tell me a little bit about the sort of the psychological, the mental, the spiritual makeup of folks that work at Project Veritas.
Well, I'm glad you asked. I think it means someone who is not chasing after rewards and is not living in fear. So the New York Times motto used to be without fear or favor, which, what does that even mean, without fear or favor? It means that you're not chasing after awards and you're not afraid of threats. And that's what journalism is supposed to be. So you look at the characteristics of someone. I actually interviewed some psychologists for this chapter called Character, and I've came up with a few qualities, and I'm going to list them for you. This idea of not being afraid of threats. Number one, you're incorruptible. Number two, you're not easily manipulated. Number three, you're bold, but you're balanced. So you're aggressive, but not too much so. You're driven. You are driven. I mean, nothing can get in your way. And then finally, to not chase after rewards, you're skeptical. You're politically disinterested. One of the most amazing qualities about us is that we're not political. That might shock your audience. Well, I thought James O'Keefe was political. But the Muckraker is not inherently political. It's not so much that we want to wish ill upon our foes, which is, I think, what the definition of political is. It doesn't mean my stories aren't political. I think it really comes down to my discomfort with power, and it stems from Pascal's axiom that power without justice leads to tyranny, and the Muckraker is tyranny's enemy. And finally, we're internally self-motivated. We're motivated internally, not from external stimuli, and we're always curious. If you take these qualities together, it's hard to work here unless you have these qualities, and out of every 500 people that apply, one might get a job.
Wow. You know, James, in listening to you and in reading the things that you've written, it's almost a lyrical quality, like a song. It's almost musical. There's something really bright and beautiful about it. It's got to be the most freeing, fearless sort of existence that someone could live. And it isn't so much to me, you know, the fact that you've made all these revelations, those are good, but the fact that you live your life in a way that's sort of fearless and has this lyrical quality to it, that's the thing about you that I admire so much.
Well, thank you. I'm, as you know, I'm in musical theater, and maybe there's some type of overlap there. I think in the first chapter.
Oh, I think there is. Yeah, I think definitely there is.
It's called Suffering. And in this book, I talk about this feeling of surviving the psychological abuse. You realize a new kind of superpower. You're reborn through baptism by fire, and you're invigorated by the knowledge that you're no longer a slave to fear. And you go through that. All of us go through pain in life in different ways. Every listener of this program right now has experienced extreme pain. And I think that I think that the sort of persecution that we've been through is, I would suggest, different, not more painful or less painful, but when they attack your First Amendment rights, they attack that sacred stuff of which this republic was born from. That's everything. And I think that it does involve an element of a kind of peace when you get through that and you think you can beat anything. And I describe what Solzhenitsyn describes from the Gulag Archipelago. A beneficial calming fluid pours through your blood vessels, patience and resilience, and you're no longer a slave to fear, and you no longer desire approval from these organs of propaganda. You are free to do the job, and you have people out there who trust you, and you have responsibility to live up to your mission. It really is a liberating thing, I think, and it's a beautiful thing, and we need more people doing this sort of work. Obviously, we need a handbook for those people, and that's what this book is, American Muckraker. I promise you, it'll help you understand what it's going to take to do this work and to tell the truth in this clown world that we're living in, and I very much appreciate you having me on to talk about it.
Elizabeth.
Well, James, I'm telling you, I am so grateful that, and I know the listeners are too, that you are taking this cause on, because there aren't many out there like you, and you're not a follower, you're a leader, and we are so thankful for all the work you're doing.
Thank you.
It's our pleasure to have had you on today. As I mentioned earlier, if you want to hear this interview again, you can always go to DupreeFinancial.com. I'll be posting it on our blog and radio tab. If you want to buy the book that James spoke of, it's AmericanMuckraker.com. I will also post a link to that site on the website. So just go to DupreeFinancial.com.
Thank you.
Thank you, James.
All right.
God bless
Take
you.
Care.
Take care.
God bless.
See
Bye-bye.
You.
Bye.
And we are wrapping up the first hour. Our financial guys are standing by to give us the latest on what's going on in the financial world. Stay tuned for the second hour. We'll be back in just a few minutes. The purple trees were driven down the